Brethren, we're continuing. Well, before I want to ask one thing offhand. Did anyone receive anything regarding, via email, I guess, regarding 666 from Revelation 13? Did anyone receive anything on that? I'm not going to take the time. Okay. If you do, somehow there's just a little controversy floating around on it. I've written a little paper on it and addressing it. If anyone runs into that, I'd be happy to share it with you. But if you don't run into it, then you don't need to be bothered with this. Okay. So with that then being said, we're picking up in Revelation, the 17th chapter, verses 15 to 18 was what we had put together as 15 to 17 as a grouping for today in the notes. But I want to ask, was there anything left over or any comments or questions from last week's study? We had concluded with verse 14, of course. Would anyone have anything on that? Okay. So, Brother Jeff, good morning. Could you read for us in Revelation 17, verses 15 to 17, please?
Then the angel said to me, "The waters you saw, where the prostitute sits, are peoples, multitudes, nations, and languages. The beast and the ten horns you saw are will hate the prostitute. They will bring her to ruin and leave her naked. They will eat her flesh and burn her with fire. For God has put it into their hearts to accomplish his purpose by agreeing to hand over to the beast their royal authority until God's words are fulfilled."
Okay. All right. Very good. Thank you. So, that was not the King James, and we're glad it read well. But in the King James, there's one thing we wanted to just highlight regarding translation, and that is in verse 16, the King James reads, "And the ten horns which thou sawest upon the beast, thee shall hate the whore." But it's generally accepted that the better rendering is instead of upon, it's the word and. So rereading it, "And the ten horns which thou sawest and the beast, these shall hate the whore." So that's, that's a note. Did anyone have anything on that they wanted to say? Okay. Did anyone have any other observations on the better Greek at all? On these verses? Oh, okay. We weren't aware of anything offhand. So, our verse 15. What do we learn again from verse 15? It actually does an interpretation for us. Who could elaborate on that? Brother Dan.
Well, Brother Rick, we have verse 15, "And he saith unto me, the waters which thou sawest, where the horse sits, are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues." And so when we open this chapter in verse 1, which read, "And there came one of the seven angels which had the seven vials and talked with me, saying unto me, come hither, I will show thee the judgment of the great whore which sitteth upon many waters." So right there, Brother Rick, we have the great whore, which is the church element, the papacy, sitting on many waters, which is interpreted here for us as peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. So it's the people who are always supporting the Catholic Church, the hierarchy of the Catholic Church. So it's letting us know throughout the world, the European world, the Catholics, the religious element, is supported by the Catholics or the people, we'll just leave it there. Over.
All right. Very good. Very good. Anyone else on that? Verse 15? Okay. We've talked it through a number of times visiting that, and it's brought out by Brother Dan, and in a very simple way, it's Roman Catholic people, the waters, support the religious element of the papacy, the harlot, regardless of whether or not she is part of a government, a church state government. And she has wide support. And even though much is said amongst some circles about the demise and the lowering of the attendance at churches in Western countries, you can go on the internet and you can Google it. There's still over 1 billion Roman Catholics counted in the world today. Where they're growing is shifting. They have growth in Africa and South America and other areas rather than growth in Europe and North America. And not that they're gone. And we always like to remember that there are Roman Catholics in very high positions of authority in the United States government, as well as other governments of Western power. So it's not always necessarily the numbers of people, but that people support her. The majority of our Supreme Court are Roman Catholic. Our president is Roman Catholic. And it's just that we're just bearing in mind that they can have an outsized influence. So numbers isn't the bottom line. But, okay, that being said, Ruth?
I find this some of these verses in this chapter encouraging because the Lord made it so obvious who we're talking about to anybody who has any conception of world events and history. And he made sure that there was enough clues in here, like verse 9, here is the mind with wisdom, the seven heads or seven mountains on which the woman sitteth. Well, that's, everybody knows that's wrong. And then the verse we just read, 15, that she's supported by the whole people from the whole world, peoples, multitudes, nations, tongues. It leaves nothing to the imagination. We don't have to think this is something besides this. And then in verse 18, we haven't got to yet. Make sure we know it's the great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth. And there was this one brother who got the truth by reading this. He was a Roman Catholic. And he was telling me his experience. He read Revelation 17 and he worked with a brother and he knew he was religious. It was George Tabak. And he went to George Tabak and said, and he knew he was Roman Catholic, real strong Roman Catholic, had seven kids. And he said, what do you think of Revelation 17? And George Tabak didn't know what to say because he knew it was this real strong Roman Catholic, so he was trying to give it to him gently. And the brother goes, I think it's the Roman Catholic Church. And George Tabak was absolutely floored, so then he got a really big witness and came with the truth, but he read it on his own and it was so obvious to him. So anyway, I appreciate that the Lord, when the Lord really wants you to know something, he makes it the way you can really figure it out. Over.
All right, very good. So true. And it's written by many that all the reformers understood that this represented papacy back in the day. Very good. Sister Debbie.
I just find it interesting when, you know, you read a little bit of the history, and I don't know if this relates, but it almost seems like a little like the French Revolution was a mini version of what's coming. When you say the ten horns and the beast hate the whore, well, there was a lot of times, you know, before, even before the Reformation, that the kings of the earth hated papacy because they couldn't get around her. It's like, that's what Henry VIII did. He tried to get around her and, you know, create his own religion. But also the people hated papacy because they, you know, papacy would take their money that they needed. I mean, it wasn't everybody, but there was enough so that there was, you could feel it in the population, this hatred. But it, I guess it wasn't time yet, but it's almost like a mini idea of what may go on in the future. I don't know. Over.
All right. Thank you. Berlin.
Brother Rick, along the lines of Catholics being in high places and brought out, I looked at a Pew Research poll looking at the faith on the Hill, the makeup of those in the House and in the Senate. And in the House, there are 31% are Catholic, 55% Protestant. In the Senate, 25% Catholic and 59% Protestant. And just as brought out, six of the Supreme Court justices are Catholic. And then they made a comparison of since 1961 to 2021. In 1961, there were 100 Catholics making up the House of Representatives, and today there's 158 Catholics. So we can see that that number is growing, and the Protestants are shrinking a bit. And 398 in 1961 to 294 in 2021, but still the majority, like 88% of both. The House and the Senate are made up of those who claim to be Christians. Over.
All right. Very good. Thank you. Good info. Okay. Anything else on verse 15? Sister Cindy.
Well, just in line with what Brother Dan was saying, I this is before my time, but Jack Kennedy, when he was the first Catholic president, and they didn't want him because he was Catholic, and he had to declare that I take my orders from Washington, not from Rome. And fast forward to today, Joe Biden is our president. He's Catholic. Nobody challenged it. Nobody cared. And ironically, he's married to Dr. Biden, and I think she was a divorcee. I'm not exactly sure what her history is, but when they met with the Pope, she had to wear the black mourning stuff, and which I thought was kind of odd. He's like, wait a minute, he's a Catholic president. You're not going to even make an exception for her. And so anyway, I just thought that was kind of odd. Over.
Yeah, I read something on the black veil women, and there was an angle that I had not read before, and it had to do with the country that that person was from and their position, and it related to they were supposed to be of royalty and Roman Catholic royalty, not Protestant royalty, but Roman Catholic royalty. And someone had just visited and didn't have to wear that black, and that was explained. You know, not royalty, like powerful royalty, but just ancient bloodline royalty, princess or something. Anywho, for what it's worth, it, but it's still all part of the big charade the papacy likes to play, the emperor's clothes. All right, thank you. Anything else on verse 15? So the harlot, the religious element of papacy as continually supported by Roman Catholic believers from around the world. Verse 16 here, and Ruth, could you read that for us, please? Well, why don't you read 16 and 17?
And the 10 horns which thou sawest and the beast, these shall hate the whore and shall make her desolate and naked and shall eat her flesh and burn her with fire. For God hath put in their hearts to fulfill his will and to agree and give their kingdom unto the beast until the words of God shall be fulfilled.
Any opening comments?
Well, it refers back to verse 12, and the 10 horns which thou sawest are 10 kings which have received no kingdom of yet, but received power as kings 1 hour with the beast. And the former supporters of the woman turn on her. So it reminds me of Jezebel, picture of Jezebel, the former supporters threw her out the window and she was eaten by dogs. So this is the final destruction. Burn her with fire. He's making very clear that this is the final destruction. She's not coming back.
Okay. Very good. So true. Thank you. Sister Debbie.
I have a note, maybe from an earlier study, that verse 16, that is when the plagues are poured out. Or is the plagues poured out at the beginning of this and by the end of it, then they shall burn her in fire? Over.
All right. So we think by the time we get to in the sequence of events, by the time the events of verse 16 takes place, the plagues, seven last plagues have already been poured out and they are having their effect. And the effect is that the nominal Christians, the bundled tares, are burned as bundles. So it demonstrates that, as a result of the exposure of the harlot woman and her harlot daughters, the Protestants, the people who formerly supported them are going to turn on them and are no longer under religious restraint. And they tear the system down. You mentioned the French Revolution earlier as a picture, and that's true. And we would suggest that back in verse 14, where we read this war, where the eighth head with the 10 kings for 1 hour give power to this church-state system, and they make war with Jesus and those that are with him, the 144,000, but they can only make war on the feet members. But it tells us that Jesus gets the victory and those that are with him, that is the 144,000 that are sealed, they all get the victory, but the final feet members who are sealed of the 144,000, they have the privilege of expressing the seven last plagues, whereas Jesus and the entire church, all of the 144,000 on the other side of the veil, as it were, in the spirit realm, are directing the issues to allow their representatives on earth to be in a position to give expression to these final plaguing truths that expose Satan's antichrist systems. And the reaction is that the people will no longer be held under those restraints. As we read in Revelation 16, eventually ends with hail, hard truths, beating down, all people, beating down the errors, destroying their errors, so that everyone will be affected, by these truths being expressed. So our verse 16 here, the 10 horns, which you saw upon the beast, which is the King James. And it's true. We did see the 10 horns upon the beast. That's true. That's where they were back in, verses, 11, 12, and 13. These 10 horns are 10 kings, and they will have power 1 hour, and they give their power to that beast. And the beast is the eighth, and it's of the seven, goes into destruction. And the seven were seven heads or forms of government, so the eighth is one of those. It's a repeat of a church-state form of government over the Roman Empire. So we're reading that these kings or these civil authorities, 10 representing the completeness, they and the beast, now putting the proper Greek word in verse 16, and the beast, they are going to hate the harlot. So what part of the beast hates the harlot? Well, the part of the beast that hates the harlot particularly would be the people, the body of the beast. And the body of the beast, the people, those were the bundled tares. Those were those who were cooperating with a church-state system for this 1 hour. But now they're revolting. And along with the civil powers that supported her, the 10 kings. And they hate the religious element, particularly of papacy. They hate the religious element, the harlot, because it's the harlot's false doctrines that made them drunk to cooperate, which deceived them, which made them cooperate in a church-state government for this hour. And as far as the people are concerned, at the time when the seven last plagues are poured out and the hail of hard truth beats them down, even the Roman Catholics will no longer want to support the papacy, but turn on her. The bundled tares are now burned. They are destroyed as nominal Christians. They recognize that they were promised heaven if they only went to mass or burned candles or attended church and contributed money. All that now is exposed as that is not get you to heaven. And they rebel against all of this. So they are going to make her desolate, naked, eat her flesh, and burn her with fire. And so there's these various aspects. We did have that picture of Jezebel. We do mention that. And it was brought out, and I think we even cite that. Let's take a look at that in, Second Kings 9. There we go. So let's read there. Second Kings 9, and Sister Cheryl, could you read for us? And I'm going to have you read verses 30 through 37.
Second Kings 9:30-37. And when Jehu was come to Jezreel, Jezebel heard of it, and she painted her face and tired her head and looked out at a window. And as Jehu entered in at the gate, she said, "Had Zimri peace, who slew his master?" And he lifted up his face to the window and said, "Who is on my side? Who?" And there looked out to him 2 or 3 eunuchs. And he said, "Throw her down." So they threw her down, and some of her blood was sprinkled on the wall and on the horses, and he trod her underfoot. And when he was come in, he did eat and drink and said, "Go see now this cursed woman and bury her, for she is a king's daughter." And they went to bury her, and they found no more of her than the skull and the feet and the palms of her hand. Therefore, they came again and told him, and he said, "This is the word of the Lord, which he spake by his servant Elijah, the Tishbite, saying, In the portion of Jezreel shall dogs eat the flesh of Jezebel." and a carcass of Jezebel shall be as dung upon the face of the shield in the portion of Jezreel, so that they shall not say, this is Jezebel.
Okay, good. Thank you. Do you have some opening comments here for us, please?
Well, we do see the relationship in the picture, the Anatite, that Jezebel, who represented, you know, the religious, with the, you know, with Ahab, the state and church relationship, that there will be no more, and it will be the people that will turn on her, and there will be the smoke of her remembrance, according to the Lord's word. So these weren't no relationship with the Lord. They're burned tares, and they were a false religion. Over.
Yep. Okay. Very good. Thank you. Further comments on these verses here in this picture? Sister Cindy.
I have a question. I understand the skull is bone, the feet is bone, but I don't understand the palms of the hands. The palms of the hands is a fleshy, meaty thing, and if dogs were eating, they would have gone after something fleshy and meaty. So I don't understand that. I don't understand it. Over.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's a good question. Ruth?
Seems to me like it's an evidence that this is directive of the Lord, because that's exactly the point. Dogs, if dogs were just being dogs, they would have eaten everything except the bones, but you don't have any of the rest of the bones of the body. You have the skull, the feet, right? The feet?
Yep.
And the palms of her hands. So it reminds me of the mark of the beast. You either had it on your forehead or in your hands, and then the feet represented your ways. So the memory of her will be her doctrine, her ways of conducting herself, and her hands being cooperation with all this iniquity. And that'll be remembered, because we have the picture of the smoke going up forever. Her memory will be dung upon the ground. They'll remember that she's dung. Over.
Okay, very good. Very good, thank you. Brother Chris.
Yeah, it's just the Lord gives us a similar lesson in Leviticus chapter 8. With the anointing of Aaron, and that would be verse 23 and, 22 and 23. And he brought the other ram, the ram of consecration, and Adam and his sons laid their hands upon the head of the ram, and he slew it. And Moses took the blood of it and put it upon the tip of Aaron's right ear and upon the thumb of his right hand and upon his great toe of his right foot. So just as Sister Ruth is bringing out, this, represents the hand of cooperation with the Lord, the foot of walking in the path of righteousness, of consecration. Other places we have the anointing between the eyelids, showing the your mind, you're in cooperation with the Lord, and that's in Deuteronomy as well. So just want to bring that comparison now, showing that the Lord's consistent in his symbolic pictures. Over.
Okay, very good. Appreciate that too. Makes good sense. Scriptural symbolism of the head, the hands, and the feet. Brother Dan.
Yeah, the Sister Ruth's comment brought to my mind Revelation 13, where the mark of the beast was taken in the forehead and in the hands. So again, showing those intelligently cooperating and those working along with papacy in harmony with them. So you know, we have the same symbolism. pointing out that it will be remembered. These God dishonoring doctrines, pictured by that skull and all who cooperated with her, throughout her, especially heyday, but even here, in the end, until, the truth uncovered, their terrible, terrible errors. And this was God's doing, to destroy her, but leaving a remembrance of, you know, what she has done throughout, you know, her history. Over.
Okay. Very good. Very good. Other comments on this picture? Well, one point, and it might not appeal to everybody, but the skull, the hands, and the feet represent the extremity of the human body. The extremity. You can't get lower than your feet. You can't get further stretched out than your hands. And you can't get higher than your head. Unless you raise your hands up above your head, but now you're back to your hands again. But it seems to demonstrate that these remainders of the extremity of the body, all the rest is gone. But it's just demonstrating that the Lord allowed the dogs to consume everything of Jezebel right to her extremities, and her extremities are left to identify that this is her. So that in our picture, all we're saying in the end again is that here in Kings, we had Jezebel picturing the harlot painting her face when she sees her doom is at hand. So it demonstrates that in the future, papacy will again try to present itself in a public fashion as being desirable, not with anathemas at first, but rather with a social message of acceptance and love until it becomes part of the church state government, this eighth head. And once it's in a position to be able to exert its influence, like Herodias and Salome of old, or Jezebel of old, then once she's in this illicit relationship actively in the church state, then her murderous, conniving, devious behavior manifests itself in trying then, as it were, to enforce the marking of the papal beast or the Protestant daughters on all who would come under the jurisdiction of a church state government. And those who would refuse the mark, who would refuse to cooperate or assent to those errors, they then would be killed, symbolically represented as being considered heretics, non-Christian, and even leading to actual persecution. So this is helps us get this snapshot picture in 2 Kings of what we've been seeing more broadly represented in the Revelation. Brother Chris.
Now, all of the symbolic picture of the hands. If he had just mentioned hands, we would have got it. Hands and feet would have been the same. But he specifically says the palms of her hands. And that just makes me think of like the phrase hand over fist. Or because she was always taking. The palms of her hands were always out taking from people in every way. Emotionally, of their material, their resources, their beliefs. In every way, she was trying to dominate them through the religious practices as well as taking what little they have. And usually it was the poorest countries that came under her reach. So I just wanted to bring that out as well. Over.
Okay, appreciate that. Ruth, you had your hand up earlier.
I was thinking that there could be a connection in verse 37 about that Jezebel shall be dung upon the ground. This, they shall not say, this is Jezebel. I was thinking in Revelation 17 when it says burn her with fire, it's like she's cremated. There's no grave site to visit. That was it. She was scattered.
Yeah, the friends, you're right. That's a good comment, and that the friends are bringing out, all there will be in the end will be the memory of what a blasphemous, what becomes of a blasphemous system. Very good. Sister Debbie?
What's interesting, I was thinking about it, and I don't know if it was brought up because I was distracted by the zoo in here for a moment, but the idea that the dogs ate her, when you think about it, when carcasses are left out, you know, somebody throws a carcass out, it's usually the insects and the birds that get at it first and eat it. And it's interesting that it's dogs. And I'm trying to relate it maybe to the Gentiles or to the idea that dogs were considered foul maybe or vile or by the Jews. So I'm just wondering if there's any relationship to the idea of the dogs. Over.
Yeah, we suggest in the notes that this would represent the formerly nominal Christians who no longer are under papacy's sway and turn on her. The waters that supported her will become the sea that swallows her up. The seas represent the restless masses, not restrained by religious beliefs, but rather turbulent. And so that's what we think this dog class represents. They're not the horses. That's the doctrines which tread her down. She's tread underfoot by the horses, which we read about and have read about in Revelation 14 in detail, as well as in Revelation 19. But rather it's the dogs that end up the devouring. And so it's this kind of fitting. It's the horses, the doctrinal truths that will lead to the masses of people rejecting papal claims and then turning on her and devouring her like dogs. So that was the picture that we were seeing here. Anything else here in 2 Kings 9? Brother Dan.
I was just thinking something I think's obvious. this, in the end, is the only time that she, the harlot, was not able to cover up her ugliness, if you will. She's a master of disguise throughout history, and it reveals that the plaguing truths will uncover all the ugliness that she has and all the dastardly deeds that she has done, and the Lord has to set the stage for that, because when we think of, you know, it's been almost four decades or more since it was, you know, the things about the, you know, the abuse of priests with children and so on, but they've still managed to cover it up in a large sense, because the people are still supporting the hierarchy of the Catholic Church. It's had an effect, but it hasn't uncovered her ugliness, if you will, like we see right here. This is the Lord's doing. These plaguing truths will, like an X-ray, just expose everything. Over.
So true. So true. You know, we all recognize the terrible things of papacy. And even if people who don't understand the doctrinal problems that are recognizing the pedophile problems and the financial abuses and corruption and misuse of funds and the lies and the hiding, even common people can recognize that. Sister Debbie? So that then, however, it's not leading the majority of a billion Roman Catholics to reject papacy. They're still holding on. They say things like one bad apple doesn't spoil the whole bunch and so it will take the psychological moment and setting in which the Lord Jesus and the church on the other side of the veil in the spirit realm can shape the affairs on earth to allow the feet members to have, as it were, a megaphone effect in being able to present the truths. And it's so peculiar, just like with the plagues upon Egypt. You would have thought one or two or five would have been enough. But it took 10 to finally get Pharaoh to let his people go. And even then he reneged and chased after them. So it just demonstrates the blindness, the drunkenness that papacy has had, a superstitious hold over the people. And when she's empowered again in the future as a church-state arrangement, it will even seem more incredible how she's gotten to that position. But, okay. Very good. Sister Debbie.
Yeah, I just had a question on something else, if I might. I was looking at, if I could back up to verse 14, where it says, "These with the Lamb shall make war." I just had a question that in chapter 11, verse 7, it says it makes war against the two witnesses. Is this the same war, or is that two separate events? Because I thought when we were in 11, you related it to this one. So I don't remember if it was the same event or two different events. Over.
In Revelation 11, the two witnesses is the Old and New Testament. And the war being made was by the papacy, empowered as a church-state government during the so-called Holy Roman Empire period. We call it the Dark Ages. And they were persecuting the Bible. And then in the Revolution, in the Reformation, the Lord allowed for the Bible to triumph. And the Reformers had gained a victory to that extent. But what we're referring to in Revelation 18, it's not the Bible, but it's the final feet members of the body of Christ that the war is being made against. So different setting. However, the point is, papacy, whenever it can, tries to persecute the word of God and or pollute it, corrupt it, misrepresent it, or then persecute those who are presenting the truths of the Bible. So that is the MO, that's for sure. Let's take a look and compare what we've just read in 2 Kings 9 with Jezebel to Revelation 18. And Sister Molly, could you read Revelation 18 and verse 20 and 21 was just for now.
Okay, and this is from the NIV, Revelation 18, 20 and 21. "Rejoice over her, you heavens. Rejoice, you people of God. Rejoice, apostles and prophets, for God has judged her with the judgment she imposed on you. Then a mighty angel picked up a boulder the size of a large millstone and threw it into the sea and said, With such violence, the great city of Babylon will be thrown down, never to be found again.
So, Sister Molly, we're trying to make a connection to the picture we saw back with Jezebel up in this tower and the results. Can you pick out any similarities here in these verses as far as the actions?
Sure. It's very clearly saying that God has judged her, which we know that this is Babylon, and linking Babylon with Jezebel. And this mighty angel is picking up a boulder and throwing it into the sea, and it's a violent event, and Babylon will be thrown down and destroyed. So a similar picture with Jezebel being thrown down out of that tower and destroyed, and never to be found again, so that it was a complete destruction. That's all.
No, that's very good. And those are the key elements. May the brethren like to emphasize that if you're going to throw something down with violence, as it were, you're going to lift it up as high as you can to make the fall all the harder. So they like to picture that the angel, a mighty power, lifts up the millstone in preparation to throw it down violently. So they point out that this is showing there's going to be a brief exaltation of papacy in this, we suggest, in this church state government for an hour, short time, before then it's thrown down into the sea. And the sea, as we mentioned, is the irreligious masses of people. They are tossed to and fro like the wicked. Isaiah talks about that. And they're not the earth class, which shows people under religious restraint. They're stable. And their religious beliefs hold them together. But this is just the waves are thrashing about. So this shows, again, what we try to demonstrate as the dogs ate the flesh of Jezebel. And here, they would be represented as the sea class swallowing up this millstone, which represents the casting down of papacy and really churchianity, including the Protestant daughters. And that it's violent, just like the treading of the horse hoofs and the spattering of the blood of Jezebel on the tower wall as she fell, and then the dogs eating her. So both of these pictures contain that element of this final destruction of papacy. The Lord's not going to let papacy go without exposing her evils and having his just retributive judgment exercised on the system. Even though the people, the blinded people, will come up in the time of restitution, but as a system and the people who supported it, there is the trouble that they must pass through at its collapse. Sister Debbie?
You know, that makes a big difference, because when a lot of people think that it's just going to peter out, you know, and just kind of fade away, that's what I've heard. But when you think about it that way, the Lord makes it a big deal. He makes it something that people will remember, because if it just faded away, nobody would really say, what was that? You know, but this lifting it up high and then casting it down, it makes a bigger splash, as it were, so that, you know, people will remember that over.
Okay, good. Very good. Any other comments on this last little connection here to Revelation 18, 20, and 21? Well, of course, we're going to come to those verses in our study, but anything now? Okay, let's go back to our Revelation 17 and 16. The 10 horns, the 10 civil powers that have supported the beast, a church state arrangement upon which the harlot sat. The religious element of papacy was supported and gave it direction. But then these will turn on the harlot when she's exposed, and we've covered this, make her desolate. That is, of course, desolate of any support. That's clear. That she's naked. She's no longer has her coverings of pretenses, either whether it's her false doctrinal pretenses, whether it's her actual physical presentation to the public, you know, all her pomp and circumstance will be done away, and that she's they eat the flesh. In other words, like with the dogs that we read, it's a total consumption, and they burn her with fire. If there are things left, you're to burn it with fire. That would be any of the bones, so that there will be nothing left of this papal system after all her blasphemous conduct. Just when she thought she was empowered, and I might say, just when Satan thought there was Antichrist systems, he was back empowered, yet the Lord brings it to an end. Is there anything more on 16? We'll talk more about her burning in the 18th chapter. Sister Molly.
Brother Rick, I had a little bit of a question. The beast and the 10 horns you saw will hate the prostitute. They will bring her to ruin. It's the beast and the 10 horns that bring her to ruin and also the people? Or is it, can you just clarify once more? I'm sure it's been said many times, and it probably is in the notes, but I just want to make sure before we leave the verse, if you wouldn't mind.
So when we have a beast, there's a body of the beast, and the beast will have a head, and on the head will be the horns, because the head represents the form of government over the body of the beast, which is the empire. And that's the people. The people make up the body of the beast. They're under her influence. And we note that when it says the woman rides the beast, or if you will, if we look back at verse 3, carried me away in spirit in the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-covered beast, and so on. So the woman isn't sitting on the head. She's not sitting on the horns. She's sitting on the beast. So like a rider, instead of riding horses, she's riding this beast. She's supported by the people as part of a church-state government. And when she's not part of a church-state government, she's supported by the waters. She's supported by the people as a religion. They support the harlot as a religion. So that's where we make this distinction. So the part of the beast that hates the harlot are the people that she rode. The head, she was part of, church-state government, they too, the civil part, hates her. And the 10 horns represent the civil powers that were supporting her. They too hate her. So she has no friends left. Everyone who cooperates with her, when she's exposed, they all want to get away from her. In our Revelation 18, just skimming down to a couple of little points in Revelation 18, just touching them quickly, in verse 3, all nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication, and the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth are waxed rich through the abundance of her delicacy. So we're seeing this cozy relationship with the civil authorities and the financial powers. Then they're drunken. They're intoxicated with her false presentation. In verse 8, therefore shall her plagues come in one day, death, mourning, famine. She shall be utterly burned with fire. Then we get down to verse 9. The kings of the earth who have committed fornication and lived deliciously with her shall bewail her and lament for her when they shall see the smoke of her burning, standing afar off for the fear of her torment. And going on. Verse 11, and the merchants of the earth shall weep and mourn over her, for no man buys their merchandise anymore. And then it goes on. So what it helps demonstrate, these merchants are part of that body of the beast. They're part of the people who are invested in this church-state arrangement for that 1 hour, as well as these kings of the earth, these governments that are cooperating, because they're afraid of the alternative. Is there's some fear that things are going to go into anarchy unless a strong church state government doesn't step in and take control. And that's Brother Russell's presentation in the fourth volume, The Battle of Armageddon. He outlines it numerous ways and bringing out that the great fear of going into anarchy is what's going to allow for a church state government to present itself as the answer, the solution. And Brother Russell's main thinking was it was going to be a financial collapse. And we can see how easily that could happen at any time. Because everyone would be affected. So that was one thing. The fear of terrorism. It could be a third world war. I'm going to take a little aside here. Sister Debbie, I see your hand, but I'm going to take a little aside here. You might remember we didn't get involved in World War I for several years after it broke out. The war broke out in 1914 in Europe. America didn't get into the war till 1917. So we tried to stay out of it. World War II. World War II broke out in Europe. We tried to stay out of it. Because they were fighting in Poland in 39. We didn't get into it till 40. It was the Japanese bombing Pearl Harbor that got us involved in both directions. I'm making this short. It's a little more about, but we didn't want to get involved. And currently there's a ground, air, and sea war going on in Europe. Russia's invaded Ukraine. And the United States doesn't really want to get involved. And if you listen to certain parties in our government, they don't want to send any aid to Ukraine. It's not our war. Well, that's what some were saying in the U.S. government in World War I before we got involved, in World War II before we got involved, and it could happen again. That if the United States doesn't step up its support, Ukraine alone can't resist Russia. It just doesn't have the power. It has the heart. It just doesn't have the power. And Russia's being helped by North Korea and other allies. Ukraine's being helped by its allies. You see, it's formed in the same kind of way as the first two world wars. So if a government comes in, our government decides not to continue to support military aid to Ukraine, Ukraine can't stand up. Ukraine will probably fall. The NATO countries will be next in line. And then lo and behold, it's possible. I'm not saying likely. I'm just saying it's possible that then they're going to want to have U.S. soldiers involved like we did in World War I and World War II. I'm not saying it's going to happen. I'm just saying the scenario is the possibility is there. So why am I bringing that out? I'm just bringing out that financial collapse, terrorism, pandemic, someone using nuclear weapons, let the weak say I'm strong, out of Joel, the third chapter. Some rogue player like Iran or North Korea using nuclear, China invading Taiwan, or the Ukraine war going worse. All these things are possibilities that will create a fear, which might then allow for a church state government to present itself as the only viable solution. So anyway, that was a side. Sorry. Sister Debbie.
Yeah, I just kind of reminded myself, and because a lot of times we say the whore is papacy, but it's not just papacy, right? It's the scrolls rolled together in a loose confederation. It's the Protestant and the Catholic together that makes this this whore. And it's the whore and her daughters, like, you know, together. And it makes more sense, because I was thinking just papacy for a while, and then it just dawned on me, well, wait a minute, this is both, and it makes it more powerful, because the two of them together have a following that is way huger just than just one or the other. And it does span all of the Christendom. So I just wanted to bring that out, you know, and just, I don't know, just an aside, over.
Well, that's true. And where in Revelation is it brought out that the Protestants are equally involved with the papacy and the civil authorities? Where in the Revelation? We've already studied it. Where is that brought out?
Sister are you Molly. Asking me? I hope you're asking somebody else.
I am. I'm asking Sister Molly.
Okay, good.
I'm just going to take a try. Is it in Revelation 13? With the, is it the beast out of the earth that has the Protestant systems in the evangelical alliance, and then we have the image of the beast?
That's part of it. Okay. That is part of it. And then the final concluding chapters of verse 13, we have the two religious elements cooperating, the vitalized image, and the beast are cooperating together to enforce the mark. But we're looking for the civil power as well. Ruth.
I was thinking of Revelation 16:13.
Okay.
You have the beast, which is papacy, and then you have the false prophet, which is Protestantism. And then the dragon would be the civil power. And that they are all in croaking in unison, but I never thought of it as being pictured in that woman. I thought the woman at the end of 17 is just that she's like the godmother of all of them. She calls the shots, and it's like Herodias manipulating Salome, but it was still Herodias was the one who was behind it all. So that in Revelation 17, the woman is only from, I was surprised. I didn't think that she ever, the daughter systems are the, her daughters are the gods, not her.
That's true. I mean, what you're saying is true, but verse 18, Revelation 17, 18, and the woman which you saw is that great city. So it's Babylon. So I think we lump her daughters in with her at the end. Based on Revelation 16, the very verses you brought out, Ruth. But it does, I think Revelation 17, we said this at the beginning of the study, Revelation 17 is unique in Revelation because it separates the harlot and the beast to demonstrate for us that God holds papacy, Satan's chief antichrist system, as the most responsible. And so it shows us that long history. But Revelation 17 does show her harlot daughters. They do mention the harlot daughters. So we do have the Protestants there represented. But in the final church-state arrangement, the church-state government, while the papacy leads the way, the mother, yet we do think the daughters are involved. But we'll leave it there. Sister Debbie?
Just said in verse 5, I think, Revelation 17:5, it says, upon her forehead was name written, secret, Babylon the Great, the mother of the whores and the abominations of the earth. So I guess I was thinking that when you get down to verse 18, the whore becomes all together, you know, the mother and her whores together. That's what I was thinking over.
Okay. All right. Well, verse 18 sums up that it's certainly Babylon, the great city, which does include the papacy, the mother, and her Protestant daughters. But you know, it's just like when we study types and shadows in the Old Testament from Leviticus and all, you know, we have a series of different types and shadows to teach us the overall lesson. So in the book of Revelation, we have to consider the lessons from the various chapters in order to get the complete picture. So, and sometimes there's just a greater emphasis on one aspect over another. Here, the greater than 17, the greater emphasis was on the papacy as a religious system and its role. Okay, we'll have to leave it there on that. Now, in verse 17, very peculiar in one hand, God hath put in their hearts to fulfill his will and to agree and give their kingdom unto the beast until the words of God shall be fulfilled. How would we understand this verse? Sister Day.
Well, in the Young's, it reads differently. It says, for God did give into their hearts to do its mind and to make one mind and to give their kingdom to the beast till the sayings of God may be complete. So it's not to do God's mind, but to do its mind, its own mind. That's the way I was looking at it. Over.
But why is God then mentioned at all if they're just doing what they want to do? Why does it mention God in there, Sister Debbie? Why would that be?
Well, I was thinking of Pharaoh. It's the same thing with Pharaoh, that God didn't harden his heart, but he allowed that to be hardened. And God allows them, you know, their hearts to do their own mind.
So how did God harden Pharaoh's heart? It does say God hardened his heart.
So by allowing his pride to take over.
But how did he do that? I mean, literally, how did that happen? What were the events? Did he put something in his mind, or did he create events that made that happen? You're not following me. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I am following you, but I never.
It was the 10 plagues. God would create a plague. He'd give a warning, and then he would create a plague. And then Pharaoh would react. And then then God would give another plague, and he would react. And I think the setting here is God is allowing events to develop in order to bring about the demise of the Antichrist systems. Sister Debbie.
So are the seven last plagues the same thing or the same impetus like the 10 plagues and, or the seven last ones, because the first three was on everybody. But, is that like the same situation where he's pouring out these truths and he's allowing them to do their own mind?
To expose their errors, which will lead to their destruction. Yeah, pretty much the same kind of thing. Brother Chris, I was talking. You had your hand up. Sorry.
I was just, that verse 17, I think, the kings of the earth, they'll all be angry, and the beast, all these, they're being burned tares. They all look to the papacy and they're all together. The kings want to survive. The financiers, they all want to survive. They want to keep doing their thing. And it was great knowing you, baby, but you know, we hate you now because it's a popular thing to do. So they're all against her. Later, we're going to read how they're standing back going, whoa, that's way worse than I thought it was going to be. I hope we're not next, but they are. So that they're all of one mind, and this is the Lord's will. This is the process of closing the gospel age. Everything must go. So over.
Okay, very true. Very true. Good. Brother David Vickery, was that a hand?
Yes, thank you, Brother Rick. I was thinking of 2 Thessalonians 2, maybe from 10 to 12. And it just says, and with all deceivableness of unrighteousness in them that perish, because they received not the love of the truth, that they might be saved. And for this cause, God shall send them strong delusions, that they should believe a lie, that they all might be damned who believed not the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. And just to make it simpler, the Lord is bringing out what's wrong, and really it's a mercy in the end, because there won't be any more of that ever around. It won't ever be able to exist again. So anyway, thanks.
No, very true, and those are very good verses to demonstrate this atmosphere. But you make a good point, and that 2 Thessalonians 2:11. And for this cause, God shall send them strong delusions, that they should believe a lie, that they all might be judged unworthy who believed not the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. So the Lord creates the environment which will test the people. It will at times expose the errors. It will bring out truth. But it will be sometimes in history, there are just times which are great testings. I mean, you can look back and you can think of many of them. I mean, Noah's flood and the days before when he was building the ark, it was a great test in preparation. Jerusalem's destruction with the Babylonians was a great test. And then it fell. Israel in the days of our Lord at the first advent was tested and finally left desolate, and Jerusalem was destroyed in 70 AD. So here at the conclusion of the gospel age is being brought out, the Lord is exposing the errors of these antichrist systems, how blasphemous, and it's a test upon his people. And yet the finale, the grand finale, will be their exposure and final destruction. Ruth.
Sometimes in the Companion Bible, he has a whole appendix on a particular word. And he's got a whole appendix on this word fulfilled at the end of 17. And it means to make a full end, which I thought was interesting.
That is.
Wasn't just generic fulfilled, but make a full end. Over.
Very good. No, we appreciate that. And that we think is, of course, the case. So, brethren, I would like us to try to finish here. Let's read verse 18. And the woman which thou sawest is that great city which reigned over the kings of the earth. And so here, this city, of course, we know of is Babylon, mystic Babylon. And the in Revelation 16 and in verse 19, Brother Mark Kinkowski, could you read that for us, please? 16:19.
Sure. the great city was split into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell. Babylon the Great was remembered before God to give her the cup of wine of his fierce wrath.
Okay. So just there, Brother Mark, comments on this connecting with our Revelation 17:18?
Well, the great city, which, and the three parts would be the religious, civil, and I guess the people that followed them. Maybe the woman, the harlot, civil, and the heads of those governments.
So take a look back at verse 13, Revelation 16:13. Might you read that?
And I saw an angel coming out of the mouth of the dragon and out of the mouth of the beast. Yeah. Oh, the dragon and the beast. So that's, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. So there you go. You got the civil, religious, and the beast, and the false prophet. What we were just talking about, the Protestant systems.
Right.
All three of those are finally destroyed, and as it were, and then they will just be remembered before God to give her the cup of the wine of his fierce wrath. So as we're talking about at the end of 17, the final destruction of those systems. Over.
Okay. All right. Very good. That's really the key. Revelation 16, when we studied it, we saw that after the seven last plagues were poured, there was a great earthquake. That's what swallows up this city, breaks it up. It's the people revolting. The former stable earth class, religiously restrained people, are now quaking, an earthquake. So now they're no longer stable. They are throwing off their religious restraints that the papacy and the Protestants had over their people. They had them bundled in tares, but now the tares are burned. And so the end result is that the people then turn on these systems and throw them down, as it were. And so that gets us to our Revelation 17:18, the conclusion of this 17th chapter. Is that we've got the story of the harlot woman, predominantly papacy, yes. But in the end, with her demise, even her daughters end up going with her. But the 17th chapter was really largely the history of this harlot woman and the power she had exercised. As Brother Russell observes, papacy is the chief antichrist system that Satan developed. And how fitting. So, our 18th chapter, next week, Lord willing,